Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church. Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. Today we have another special episode for you today. We have a guest who was on an episode, probably the last episode, depending on how I throw this up.
Yeah, let's do it that way.
So we have Joel Fitzpatrick with us today.
Hello again.
And hello, Joel. How are you?
I'm quite well, thank you.
This time I think we're going to avoid the Trinity.
Good.
So, I think that should make everybody at the table happy. Not that the Trinity isn't a good thing.
The only two other requests we've gotten, apparently, for special episodes are, and so this eternal subordination of the Son was number one.
Sanctification.
Number two is sanctification.
Always.
Lord have mercy.
And third use of the law.
Third use of the law.
Now, I would say to the people who suggested those shows, we are taking them into consideration. You know, I'm getting some stares at the table about maybe recording those, but I would point you to our episode on good works for those. We did cover a lot of overlap with those two topics there in good works. And if you want to hear more on the third use of the law, you can go to episode 3 of the Thinking Fellows very early on in the show, and that's the law. And we cover the law there. And there's also, I'll put in the show notes in this show, just so people who are listening now can see it. But Dr. Keith has written several things that are online about the third use of the law.
And I translated Melanchthon on the third use of the law, which is up at 1517 Legacy.
So I will have direct links to that in the show notes for everybody. So even if we don't get around to doing a show on those two things, we have plenty of material from our guys up online on that particular subject. So you can find it there. So now we're going to hop into, what are we going to do? We're going to do masculinity,
yep.
Right? That's going to be our topic today. Unfortunately, Adam's not with us again.
Most masculine man I know.
Yeah. Lifts, what does he do? He deadlifts, what, 300?
That's a funny story, because he just did his deadlift of like 360, and he pop a giant blood vessel in his eye.
Oh, yeah, his eye looked messed
up.
Are
you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, dude.
Right before he went on a 10-day cruise with his wife, his eyes, blood vessel is destroyed.
Serves him right.
He goes to the doctor.
Sorry, Adam.
I think I have pink eye. She's like, did you lift something heavy? Well, maybe.
That's awesome. I don't deadlift anything.
I don't deadlift either. Yeah, no. Uh-uh.
Unless it's deadlifting like
like a six pack.
Yes.
Yeah. Get it into the fridge.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Or you could be like my daughter and say, "Yeah, I run if I'm being chased by a dog."
I work out. Yeah. You know, I do curls. It's like the cup of coffee from the table straight to my mouth.
Right.
Dude, all day long, I'll do that.
All right, Joel, so we introduced you on the last episode, but obviously we have new listeners every week, as we've learned. We have made mistakes in the past of not introducing people we would assume everybody would know. Mm-hmm. So why don't you give us a little quick rundown about what your day-to-day life looks like?
Yeah, so I am a father. I've been married to my wife for 16 years. I'm a father of two children, Colin and Awen. Awen is 13, and Colin is 10, just turned 10... what, like 2 days ago? And so just a busy dad. I am a pastor, an associate pastor down at North City Presbyterian Church. It's a PCA congregation. I've been there for 5 years and have my Master's of Divinity from Westminster Seminary, California. And I've written nothing. I do nothing. I'm just a guy, essentially.
Now, you also...
I have a beard. Not as good as Scott's, but I do have a beard.
Did you notice I cut mine?
Oh, I noticed you trimmed it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was getting a little unruly. Yeah. But you are also on Front Porch with the Fitzes.
How did you really feel about my unruly beard?
That was a nice comment.
I like trying to catch catch shotgun shells in it when we play trap. So
that's a funny story, actually. Since we're really going nowhere with this episode yet, Caleb has no. Do you want me to say? Well, we
can say that
we shoot trap.
We shoot trap every
and
week.
Caleb's ejector on his shotgun, mm-hmm. throws the shells
like really far,
like a madman,
like hard, far,
like hard and far. And so when you're playing trap with Caleb, you have to strategically place him,
uh-huh.
so that he's not taking out everybody else that's down the line from him.
Yeah, I really upset somebody we were playing with once.
It was so funny.
It hit him, and he floundered like a soccer player.
He did. He was like, mm-hmm. "You can't see me, but I'm flailing my arms." He's like, "Oh,
yeah."
And I've been hit with them. They don't weigh anything. They don't hurt.
I've had one caught in my beard.
Yeah, but yeah, it can be frustrating to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But it is fun trying to get him stuck in his beard.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a good time.
All right, so what are we talking about today, Caleb?
We're talking about masculinity. We got a couple of men around the mm-hmm. table. We have somebody who's, I think, written the book on it. I don't know if being dad is meant to be the book on masculinity. Like,
you're like, around Rod, you've been writing
somebody else here? Oh.
But I think, personally, I think having read and listened to Being Dad a couple times and your lectures, I think that is pretty definitive work on what real masculinity looks like.
Mm.
And so I think we have you around the table. We have Joel around the table, mm-hmm. And Rod, who I think sparked all this for everybody.
Rod definitely sparked it for me. I mean, I guess I'd start. We sometimes have a bit of a loose plan for episodes. I have no plan for this episode, mm-hmm. so it can kind of go anywhere it needs to. One of the greatest things I think can happen when you have any of these discussions is just to tell stories too.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you have any good stories. The reality for me is I wanted to talk about, we just finished recording with your mom, Elise, mm-hmm. the episode on the eternal subordination of the son, and this topic definitely came up, right? Mm-hmm. Since that controversy came out of this movement within evangelicalism,
that right.
sort of is labeled as a masculine movement, you mm-hmm. know, biblical masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily want to do that because I think you can get some pictures of masculinity in the text of the scriptures, but to my knowledge, nowhere does the Bible say, you know, this is masculinity. So you're mm-hmm. sort of drawing inferences from mm-hmm. pictures and analogies and stories.
Right.
But I do think it's an important topic. I've been going out teaching on being dad for several months now, and it's interesting to me because this movement that's hit evangelicalism to try to regain masculinity, in my opinion, has not hit the Lutheran church at all. And so when I go out and I talk about masculinity at all, for the guys in the audience, it's honestly the first time it's the first time they've even considered that they ought to consider it.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually phrase it from a perspective of, you know, we see a culture that presents men in either two ways.
Mm-hmm.
Men are completely submissive themselves,
right?
Dominated themselves by their culture, their workplace, their wives, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get the other side where it's all categories of power.
Yep.
Right. They're ruling by by force in some way, and that ruling by force sometimes leads to abuse, often leads to mm-hmm. abuse and crime even.
Mm-hmm.
In Rod's lecture that sort of sparked my idea to write being dad, he says that you kind of see this in Scarface, right? That when men don't know what masculinity looks like, one of the directions it goes is young boys running around the streets with carbines
right.
in their hand, you know, right. sort of dominating their neighborhood by mm-hmm. the most hyperbolic, you know, symbol of power you can get, which is a powerful gun.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought is that masculinity is actually neither one of those.
Yep. Right.
You know, and the most masculine men I've ever known, never really influenced by categories of power.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. They certainly weren't wusses.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had to put my finger on it, I'd say that at the end of the day, they were gracious.
Right.
And I have just not heard that, even in the Council for Biblical Manhood, you know, I just have not read that. There and I've not read it anywhere else. And I wanted to get two of the most masculine guys I know around the table.
It's funny you pointed at me.
Oh, I meant to point at Ken.
Oh yeah, sorry. That's probably it was a mispoint.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And see, what do you guys think? Where are we on this?
Yeah, I mean, I would rather hear Rod think about this because Rod is so wise. I think that the stories that you tell Scott in your book about Rod were so, for me, were formative in many ways. And so, Rod, I know you would never toot your own horn, so I'm going to do it for you. The fact that that Rod was this kind of picture of grace and generosity in your life, Scott, that formed so much of your thinking on your own parenting and being a man, I think speaks volumes. Like you said, there's not a lot of proof texting you can do on masculinity from the Bible. What there are what you said before. There are stories that we can draw implications from. But even in those stories have implications for all believers, whether they're right. men or women.
Absolutely.
And so it's not like you can go and say, even the parable that you used in the book, the parable of the prodigal son, the father's role in that has incredible implications even for women in the church.
Absolutely.
And so I think that you learn more about masculinity from men who you see in action, from men who you see in work, like you described Rod. For me, it was my dad. Than you do from necessarily even reading books on it, from reading even some of the stories in Scripture. I mean, the men in Scripture are incredibly flawed. It's not like you can look at David and say, hey, look at King David. There's a picture of masculinity, unless you want to say, you know, that that murder and an adulterous affair.
Right.
And
I usually actually go, in my mind, at least go to parables, which is interesting, right? So I was obviously, I used the parable of the prodigal son in the book, but the other day I was thinking about the Good Samaritan.
Mm.
And as a... think of the picture of that when two people walk by a person in need. Now, I'm not drawing any implications of who we are or any of that. I'm not even trying to do that. But just as a picture, what it communicates to me about this idea of what is masculinity, when two people walk by a person in need, one person stops and is gracious and cares for and delivers, right, and pays for. And asks nothing in return and is completely quiet about it, is not blowhard about it.
Yep.
The other night we had our pastor who's been on an extended leave of absence. He's been sailing down through the coast of Mexico for the last year. He came over. They're back for his daughter's wedding, and he came over for dinner last night. And he told me the story last night of a... He was at a pastor's conference when he was a pastor in Northern California. He was at a pastor's conference in Reno. And as they're walking by one of the, you know, the shady downtown hotels in Reno, a prostitute came stumbling out and literally fell upon this one pastor who picked her up and supported her. And right at that moment, she started doing, you know, what she does as a prostitute and overly fondling him. And he, realizing that this was being seen by all the other pastors, kind of pushed her away. And another pastor that was there grabbed her, picked her up, hailed a cab, quietly put her in the cab, quietly paid for the cab, gave the cabbie extra money to make sure she got home all right. And I thought whether that can be a picture of a lot of things, but one picture that it served for me, and I'm not even sure Pastor Hodel intended it this way, was that I thought to myself, that's a masculine man.
Right? Yeah, that's a real man.
That's a real man right there. Now, that's not... biblical masculinity, as I read it, as we were preparing for the, you know, the eternal subordination of the son episode. But to me, that's masculinity. I mean, I think that's how it's characterized in the text when it's characterized positively, either by picture. Even the times where the patriarchs are most masculine is when I think they're actually being gracious.
All right, so you want a few stories?
I love stories.
All right. I used to work for my father when I was young as a file clerk in his medical office. So I'd hear some of the office scuttlebutt. There was this beautiful blonde southern nurse with whom I was sure I was in love, and she was sick. And my dad got wind of it, and I happened to overhear the conversation in one of the examining rooms. Frida, are you sick today? Yes, doctor. Well, I want you to go home and get well then. Answer, my husband and I can't afford that, doctor. Answer, Frida, I run this office. You'll be paid anyway. Now go home till you're well. Mm. And don't worry about the money. You'll be paid for it anyway.
Mm.
His lab tech, Japanese guy, started to train me in basic lab stuff, lab analyses, CBCs, urinalysis, as part of my work hours. During one of those sessions, Carl looked at me and asked, do you know why I work for your dad, Rod? I answered, no. Carl said, because he pays me twice what other lab techs are paid on the one condition I'd never talk about it.
Hmm.
I'd work for your dad anytime, anywhere.
Hmm.
Let's see. Oh, here's another one. Every semester I found out, my dad would drive over to the University of Washington Medical School and ask what seniors were going to have to drop out for lack of money. Then he would pay the tuition for their whole year's costs and their books cost on the one condition that they never were told where the money came from. Out of the blue, I got a phone call at my fraternity house. He asked, did you once say that you'd like a sports car? I answered, Dad, I'd love a sports car. He said, well, I just saved a young man's life in surgery, and he told me he'd bought an MGA, a convertible, and that he hates the thing and wants to dump it as soon as possible. I think you need that MG. During my senior year of high school, a few friends and I would regularly plan to study together at our house in the evening. It would always last just a while, and we'd end up playing poker instead. My dad would come down to the basement, fix iced Coca-Colas and buttered popcorn, bring them down to us while we were, quote, studying in the basement. Notice that we were playing poker. He would sit down for a few hands, lose $50, and then go upstairs again. Once when I was in high school, my dad came home from the office, looked around at the dinner table, and said to all of us, go pack your bags. Tomorrow morning, we're flying to Hawaii for a couple of weeks.
Hmm.
A Buick salesman was bugging my dad to trade in his Buick for a new one. My dad answered, the one I've got now is just fine for the time being, but thanks. The guy would not stop. He went on, oh, Doc, take this one for just the weekend. Try it. 59 white convertible with red and white tuck and roll upholstery. The guy wore Dad down, and he consented. I had no idea of any of this, but saw that beautiful convertible when I arrived at our Puget Sound beach place. Dad smiled, tossed me the keys, and said, have a good weekend.
That's so awesome.
One time we were driving on our way up to our farm. We would drive by Fort Lewis, and my dad pulled off to the side of the road, and he said, come with me, Rod. He opened the car trunk, grabbed a tire iron and some newspaper, and started digging up some very small Douglas fir trees. He wanted to plant them up at our beach. He knew it was completely illegal. It was posted as such. So we rushed to dig up a few dozen of those little trees, wrapped the roots in newspaper, and put them in the car trunk. All this very, very hurried, rushed. In the rush of it all, we finished. Dad quickly slammed the car trunk shut and cut his favorite fly rod in two.
Mm.
It is a perfect time, opportunity for a moral lecture on stealing from government property. Nope, just hilarious laughter on his part and ours. Anyway, over and over and over and over and over and over and over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again and again and again and again and again and again.
Mm.
So I guess after the break, Joel, I want to have you tell some stories because you said your dad is that picture for you.
Mm.
I think that's awesome. But why is it that these pictures help us so much to understand it? I mean, this is one of those things to me. Caleb said I wrote a book on it, and I kind of did, I'd say, but this is a hard thing to write about.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Because you're writing about your perception of pictures, right? It's almost like doing a book on art in a way where you're trying to say, you know, what emotions do I get out of this piece of art, when we're really discussing sort of an emotion we get out of an experience that we have with a man.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most powerful, and I tell people to watch these all the time, these gathering of men by Robert Bly and Bill Moyers.
Watch
They're actually up on YouTube. I tell people to watch them all the time, and I don't know why, other than the fact that when you see it, you see what you essentially see are men telling stories and sobbing. and you walk away from it saying, that's the most masculine thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And you can't even explain why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bly's an atheist.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started reading his book,
Iron John.
Yeah. Yep. And I'm probably about 100 pages into it right now. And it's very interesting to me. I think one of the reasons why we have to look to pictures as opposed to actually saying this is what masculinity is because masculinity is so multifaceted. It's almost like it's a diamond. And it has all these different facets that show off different colors of what the diamond is. And yet none of the single facets is the entire diamond. Mm-hmm. And so we look at pictures because in you, I see a picture of masculinity in one way. In you, I see another one. When I hear of your dad, I hear of radical generosity. I hear of kindness and fun. When I hear of you, I hear get your crap in a pile. We're going skiing.
Yep.
I mean, it's and these are both pictures of generosity.
Yep.
Both pictures of fun and kindness and mercy and grace. When I look at my own dad, I see the same sort of thing in a real care for people who are broken, for people who are struggling, for people who are weak. And I think that's one of the reasons why we look to pictures, is because in a picture you can see more of the facets at once. Mm-hmm. In a story you can hear more of the facets at one time. And as you mull over the stories, you roll it around in your brain, you start to see things that you didn't see before. And that gives you a picture. I think that's one of the reasons why Jesus speaks in parables so often.
Well, I do too.
Because it's not just as easy as here's a list of things that you have to believe.
Yep. It's almost as philosophers would say, it's denotative, right?
Yes.
You're able to defining something by verbal description is harder than pointing at something and saying it's like that over there.
Right.
And so in a parable, in a story, instead of having to systemize an explanation or a bullet point list of what masculinity is all about, you're able to point to a picture or a story or a person and say, you know, I'm not quite sure it's exactly like this, but in every case, but I know that's it right there.
Yeah, it looks and it smells like it.
Right.
Yep. I mean,
almost every time the category of power is absent.
I'd say almost every time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. It's the wrong category.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the power, the category of power, and especially power used to dominate.
Yeah, that's probably more accurate.
Is absent. I think that it is masculine to use power to protect. To use power to guard.
Sure. Sure.
But to use power to dominate and abuse, I mean, that's the exact opposite of masculinity.
When I think of some of the stories that I've heard, even as we've been talking the earlier hour, one of the questions I can't get away from is, what was your dad like?
Right.
Yeah. I just can't. I cannot escape it. What was your dad like?
Yeah.
I think he's conditioned everything here.
And maybe control is a better word than power.
Yeah.
You know, control. When I was texting with your mom last night as we were talking about the eternal subordination stuff, I said, you know, what I get out of this is compliance, like the necessity to be compliant in all things.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when compliance sets off my radar, I run the other direction because that's a category of control that I just think is rarely warranted. You know, it's just, anyway.
Yep.
We need to hit our first break, so we'll be back shortly.
Welcome to our break. As you've heard, we have with us Joel Fitzpatrick. And Joel, we didn't mention it at the beginning of the show, but you are a co-host of a particular podcast.
Yeah.
Dr. Keith has said the only podcast he will listen to.
I now listen to two.
Oh, now you listen to two.
What's the other one?
Gun Talk.
which is really a radio show, so I don't know if that counts. But
that's awesome.
They have a podcast version of it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm one of the personalities Oh, that sounds fancy, huh? Yeah. And then you'll hear the name of our podcast, and you'll be like, no longer fancy. on the podcast called Front Porch with the Fitzies. It's the one where I'm on there with my mom, Elise Fitzpatrick, and my sister, Jessica Thompson, both of whom are far smarter than me, have written far more than I have, and probably ever will. And we sit around and we talk about life and we talk about culture and we talk about the Bible and we talk about the church and we laugh a lot and we joke around a lot. And it's somewhat irreverent, I think.
I think it's hilarious.
And I think that's one of the things that people kind of buy into. I was talking to a buddy of mine, believe it or not, it was the strangest thing. I'm coaching my son's baseball team, and one of the dads of the kids that I'm coaching is a regular listener to the podcast, yeah. And he didn't even know
that it was you.
That it was me until he put two and two together, yeah. And he's like, "Dude, this is Joel," yeah. And he was telling me just how much fun it is to listen to that because he can hear Christians talk about things that they don't usually talk about in broad evangelicalism and laugh about things that they don't usually laugh about in public. And so that's the podcast. So you can find us on iTunes, Front Porch with the Fitzies, FITZIES.
And it's housed also up at Christ Hold Fast.
It's on Christ Hold Fast, which we need to say a huge word of thanks to Christ Hold Fast because they're the ones who kind of got this thing going for us. They did all of our artwork. They did all of that stuff for us. And so we're super thankful to them. And we're on Facebook. You can go and we post basically random things on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at Front Porch with the Fitzies as well. So give us a follow there. But it's fun. We have a blast doing it.
Yeah, it's a blast to listen to too. I highly recommend it. I mean, if you're not going to be into gun talk, at least listen to Front Porch with the Fitzies.
Yeah, yeah, have a good laugh, right? I mean, I think that's so much of what, so much of talk right now, circulating around our culture is so serious with
elections, wholeheartedly agree,
and with Supreme Court rulings and all of these various things, you can get bogged down in just the overwhelming amount of terrorist attacks,
right?
And sometimes you just need a good laugh.
That kind of goes into our conversation on masculinity too. I think is that one of the things that, As I look at this and I prepare to go out for speaking engagements and whatnot, one of the things you find is, if you do any research on this, that we've lost the idea altogether that men can be friends, mm-hmm. in a non-sexualized, mm-hmm. or non-homosexual, mm-hmm. kind of way. I fear the same is true for women, too. My mom has been single since my dad died in 1974, and she's has a good friend of hers named Pam, and they go do stuff all the time. And she says, mm-hmm. it's awful that, mm-hmm. everywhere she goes, people assume that they're lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it might be worse down here in Southern California than it is in other places, I'm sure. But it's funny. I did a quick Google search yesterday for, just anything out there on philia friendships among men. So brotherly love friendships among men.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost nothing, number one. And number two, what does pop up is this sort of straw man argument against homosexuality.
Yeah. Tell an R.C. Sproul story.
Mm-hmm.
One night he was watching Tombstone again.
Mm-hmm.
And Vespa said to him, R.C., how many times have you seen that movie?
Mm-hmm.
No. Why are you watching it again?
Mm-hmm.
Answer from R.C. to Vesta. Because it's almost gone, Vesta.
Mm. Mm.
Doc and Wyatt.
Mm-hmm.
Let me plug a book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a word study. Doesn't sound very interesting, but I'm going to plug it anyway.
Mm.
C.S. Lewis, The Four Loves.
Mm.
You can also get it in audio. It's one of the few things you can get where he was doing it from his own handwritten sheets, and it only later became the book.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's the only extant audio recording of him reading his own work.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And the BBC lost him doing sensible Christianity to all of England.
So when you buy
they saved the tapes on how to grow turnips in your backyard, but they lost Lewis. another reason.
But never, if you get the
never,
audio,
never
it's,
to become
it's Lewis.
Socialist.
Yeah, if you get the audio of Four Loves, it's Lewis reading it.
Yeah,
yeah.
His own notes. He's reading his own notes.
Right, in his own voice. It's great.
That's right.
Mm. Yeah.
That deeply buried. Another story. Caitlin Skoog, now in glory, but she wrote some wonderful books on Lewis. Mm-hmm. She was doing her master's thesis at the time on Narnia. Became the Erdman's book, The Lion of Judah in Never Never Land.
Mm.
But she got to have lunch. Now, in those days, she couldn't come to his house for lunch. That was not appropriate in the day. So they met at a hotel restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And she said what everybody else says after meeting with him. She said he spent the whole time asking about me.
Right.
And the other thing she said was he was the most masculine man I've ever met.
Hmm. Hmm. Hmm.
Anyway, The Four Loves.
Yeah, it's excellent. It is the word study on philia.
It is.
Yeah.
And Lewis goes, in depth describing the idea of pretty much male friendship. He does a little bit with female friendship, but pretty much male friendship.
Yep.
As philia, and it's just excellent. I highly recommend it. The audio too is outstanding. I mean, you will never get to hear Lewis
like that. That smoking baritone, right. Large-bodied sound.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a hidden treasure, that is.
All right, yeah.
Joel, so tell us some stories of your dad. You said when you think of masculinity, you think of your dad.
Yeah, so when I think of my dad, there's no... It's not like I have points in time where I'm like, this is a story of masculinity. It's just the way that he lived. There's no way kind of around me thinking that way about him. He was a guy who for sure was a strong man. He was a smart man and very, very intelligent. And yet was funny and fun. He loved children. And that's one of these things that really sticks out to me about an area of masculinity that we've lost in America is a healthy love for children. Not one that puts kids on a pedestal where they become the head of the family and it's like, oh, Johnny's got, a baseball game today, so I have to do these 800 things to get Johnny ready so that he's, dialed in for his baseball. But it was a real love and commitment, a commitment to seeing kids, be led to Jesus. And he was always involved in children's ministry at our church. Always involved in VBS, Vacation Bible School. If you don't know what that is, it's like kids come to your church for a week, you teach them about Jesus for a week, and then you send them off and you play games and things like that. He would do that and still does it to this day. I mean, I think it was, 3 weeks ago that he was at VBS and he was dressing up like a character to be able to play around and show these kids Jesus. I mean, that's a part of masculinity about him that just sticks in my brain and has shaped and formed me as a man. As I think about how do I interact with kids? My dad was always fun. Like, kids wanted to be around him because he was fun. They never knew. It's what you describe as a you catastrophe in your book. You just never knew what was coming next because he's just wild and was fun in that way. And yet, he was fiercely protective. He didn't countenance any sort of foolishness when it came to people who were weak or to people who were in a position where they could be taken advantage of. My dad wasn't the sort of person who would see that and exploit the position. In fact, he would do what he could to protect them, so much so that he owned a business. A business where we would go in and do, water damage restoration, fire damage restoration, cleaning people's carpets. And I can't tell you how many of his employees were former ex-cons who couldn't get jobs anywhere else.
Interesting.
He would hire them and then put them into multi-million dollar mansions in San Diego. Now, for some people, they'd look at that and say, what the heck are you doing? And there were times where, you know, that came back to bite him. But he was always, always willing to...
take the risk.
Take the risk to see someone who was in a position of disadvantage be able to further their life, whether they were believers or not.
Yep. One of the things I say in the book, and I would be open to being challenged on it, to be honest with you, is that I say that a masculine love is risky and it's willing to take risk too, and that it's we sometimes, one of the things in popular evangelical literature on it is that masculinity is protective in a, you know, sort of a systematic kind of way, right? That's one of the systematic categories of masculinity is protective.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that's kind of interesting because when you look at every masculine man in a parable that Jesus tells is taking a risk and a pretty big one too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have those categories sort of upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Risking loss of love, risking loss of business, right?
Right.
If one of your employees steals.
Mm-hmm.
It's risky business
to
actually be masculine because you're not taking the safe route of being a wuss and you're not taking the safe route of having, you know, the most power.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking this middle road of being kind and gracious, strong in your kindness and your graciousness. Even in a particular way, sort of powerful in your kindness and your graciousness, but risky.
Right, and it's being risky and opening yourself up to vulnerability.
Right,
and I think that's
and a man does that in a particular way, not like a woman.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why, as we were talking about, you know, these videos that you tell guys to watch, and there's men weeping there. I mean, that's a vulnerable moment for a man. It's a vulnerable moment for a man to open himself up to other men that way, and I think that's why we lose male friendship. Is because guys don't know how to be vulnerable with other guys without that guy using that vulnerability against him. There's that fear built in that if I cry in front of you, you're going to take advantage of me in my weak state.
I've lost the power.
Right. One thing that I loved about my dad that he would do with us all the time, mom just reminded me of this, is he would take us at midnight to see Star Wars premieres.
Yeah. Terrific.
I mean, it's just so much fun.
Yep.
You know, and even with the really bad Star Wars that came out, you know, the three prequels that are just terrible.
I took Caleb to that when he was, I think, 4 years old.
Yeah,
really?
Four years old, yep.
I took my son to that when I was in Strasbourg doing my doctorate.
Uh-huh.
All subtitled in English, but at least you got to see it.
Yeah.
Another one I remember was my kids, though we lived in California, didn't get to snow. I didn't go driving up to where the snow was. And they were in bed one night there in Strasbourg, and we had a snowstorm. And I went and woke them up, told them to get dressed.
Get your crap in a pile. We're going outside. Right.
Yeah. We're going to go have a snowball fight. They had no idea what I was saying.
Right.
But at 11:30 at night, they woke up, got dressed. We went out in front of the apartment house, and there was a Catholic parish across the street with lighting. And we had a snowball fight for an hour. Then they went back to bed.
And it's that sort of thing where it's like... that's risky. That's dangerous because your kid will wake up the next day. We were exhausted. I'm sure we were disasters to deal with. You know, you have to deal with...
We're from the sugar high at midnight to the crash at 3 a.m.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And yet, those are stories. Those are like life-shaping memories.
Yep, they are.
People. And so there's this sense in which I think masculinity... looks to the fun of life. And as a guy who I was just down in Mexico with, he said, you know, Joel, at times you just got to take calculated risks with kids. We were down building houses in Mexico and kids are up on the roof, no safety ties, no nothing like that. They're just standing on 2x4s.
And kids just do not get that today.
No.
I can honestly say that one of the transformative times in my life is when I was 18, hadn't even graduated from high school yet. I moved out of my house and went to live up in Lake Arrowhead and work at a camp.
Mm-hmm.
During the summer, I was a lifeguard. During the rest of the year, I was basically anything, like mop the floor, re-roof the lodges, build walls,
right,
clean up the fire pits, whatever, need, you know, snow plow at 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation of the men that were there that I would just sort of just do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the risks that were involved, that was formative to me, mm-hmm, in ways that I look, then I, you know, flash forward 20 years, whatever, and I'm associate dean at Concordia, and 300 new freshmen, 18-year-old freshmen boys come in a year who are the age I was when I was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And what they see as risky is, you know, driving 10 feet without putting their seatbelt on while the, right, thing's beeping at them.
Right.
And I think, how do you ever calculate that part of love and masculinity is being willing to take risks?
Mm.
If everything that could ever hurt you or anyone, right, else has been completely removed out of your life.
That's right.
Right.
I don't get what we're thinking as a culture, mm, when we go down this path. I think it is one of the most short-sighted things that we've done culturally to overprotect our kids. And when we do it in the name of protection,
right,
which makes it sound great, right? Mm-hmm. We want to protect them. We want them to be safe. Yeah. Makes it sound great, but how it, mm-hmm, plays out is that they're actually never safe because they've never been able to experience a real
for
risk.
For boys, it's, yeah, a catastrophe.
It's a catastrophe, yeah, which is
catastrophe.
Why this book I recently read spent the first chapter bemoaning Eldridge, Wild at Heart.
Mm.
But I got to give that book props. I mean, I know he's turned it into a cottage movement, mm-hmm, which could be good, bad, or otherwise. I don't really give a crap, to be honest, mm-hmm, with you. But mm-hmm, the truth is that he said some real stuff in that book about, yes, the necessity to equate love,
mm-hmm,
in the way that a guy sees it,
yep,
mm-hmm, as risk.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, or is at least risky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, man, good on him for it. And, yeah, good on him for his success, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
can I say screw these guys?
Yes, that, I think we still get clean.
I mean, uh-huh, screw these guys who, uh-huh, just are attacking him for it.
Right, right. And there's a sense in which when we so overly protect our children, then we don't teach them what it means, not just to take risks physically and put their learn their limits physically, but also what it means to serve other people, to when they're standing there at the church where I'm a pastor at, we have a giant grassy amphitheater. And the kids love to play baseball and football and soccer in the amphitheater. And so...
Terrific.
Great. Fantastic. I love that. It's a chance for them to get hurt. It's a chance for them to scrape their knees. But they don't learn what it is to take the risk of looking at an elderly man taking out the garbage and saying, I'm going to put this down, this ball down, so I can go serve this elderly man. And I'm going to lose the fun that I have over here so that I can gain the reward of serving over here, so I can gain what it means to be, what it means to give of myself, to, yeah, die to myself so that someone else can live.
Which is a risky proposition.
It absolutely is, because, right, it costs you emotionally, it costs you in your friendship, it costs you in your, right, time. And yet in that way, I think this is one thing that, as I was coming up here thinking about it, you know, I forget where I read this quote, but it's like, God never asks us to do anything that he didn't already ask Jesus to do. And it's like, that's just such a beautiful picture of Christ. Christ, this one who came down and took, if you want to call it a risk, to come down and to become a man, to die for this broken people, knowing he would be hurt. In that way, it's like, man, masculinity grabs a hold of that and says, I'm going to die so that everyone else can live. And it's not in a law way.
Right.
It's in a response to the beauty of what Christ has done to you, has done for you. It's not like, do this and live. It's like, done for you. You're alive, and this is, yeah, what it means to live.
This is what being alive looks like.
Right.
It's like what I say with the Ferdy Nestegem book. It's called Free to Be. And I say, you know, the reality is that you're free to be what God has already said you are.
Mm.
Which is his. We probably need to wrap up. I think, man, it might be a cause to get the fitzes down here again, because over the break we were discussing with your mom what this looks like for women,
mm-hmm,
when they have never experienced a masculine man, and which, to be honest with you, my wife has pointed out to me multiple times too,
mm,
is that what it basically equates to for women, sadly enough, when they don't have a man around you know, either by actual physical absence or emotional absence or abuse, who is this actual picture of masculinity, is that it equates to sexuality. And that the only understanding of relation that they have between a man and a woman is sex. Which easily, and then we were talking about porn and the awfulness that comes along with that. And, you know, that comes out then to sexual conquest on the side of guys. So one of those two categories, right? That's that abuse of power category. So maybe we need to do that at some point. Maybe after our apologetics series, we can do some of that. But I think that's important, too. And then I was sitting here thinking to myself, get three dads sitting around the table and start talking about masculinity, and within 5 minutes, you're going to get to fatherhood, which is what we did, right?
So, yeah.
All right, Joel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
me,
guys.
We appreciate it, as always. Rod, thanks for the stories. One of these days, we'll tell the stories of you, like you tell of your dad. So, all right.
Thank you for listening to The Thinking Fellows, and we'll catch you again next week.